Welcome to episode 145 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We're recording a couple days after January 1st, so we wish you all peace, prosperity, and good health. And for Mark, we hope that you have pain-free mobility this year.
Well, my PT was very proud of me. I'm busting through their checkpoints in terms of flexion, so I'm pleased with how it's going. And I graduated to a cane, which is nice, yesterday, so that's good. Anyway, on this podcast, we highlight poems or patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get them all, about 240 a year, subscribe to EE Plus. You can get a poem every day, plus a great primary care reference, newly updated, 800 chapters, thousands of interactive tools, EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. For listening, go to IAFP.com and follow links to their education webpage. This week on the pod, we discuss antiplatelet meds for preventing dementia, post-stroke blood pressure control, guidelines for managing patients with chronic cardiac disease, and probiotics for patients with irritable bowel. I think that whenever I say IBS, I'm not sure if it's irritable bowel or inflammatory bowel, but I think it's irritable bowel. Kate, tell us about dementia and antiplatelet therapy.
Yeah, this was an interesting study asking an interesting question. They did a systematic review and a meta-analysis to answer the question, does antiplatelet therapy prevent cognitive impairment or dementia? And we'll get back to that precise question towards the end of this. So these researchers searched several databases to identify randomized trials of antiplatelet therapy that reported data on cognitive function or dementia. And again, that dual outcome is going to become important in a few minutes. To be included, the studies had to have at least a year of follow-up and at least 500 participants. They excluded studies with patients known to have dementia since the development was the outcome. They ultimately included 11 trials, which was more than I would have thought they would have found, including about 110,000 participants. The average duration of trials was 70 months, which is a decent amount of time, I think. They evaluated aspirin, clopidogrel, and ticagrelor. They also included trials that compared DAPT to single antiplatelet therapy, but not DAPT to placebo, and not the antiplatelets to each other. So no comparisons in this study. Clopidogrel to aspirin trials would have been excluded. Only four of the trials were at low risk of bias. The remainder were at least high risk of bias. Some of them were at very high risk of bias. Overall, the rate of developing cognitive impairment or dementia was similar among patients receiving antiplatelet and the patients in the control group. So it was 3.5% versus 4.2%. It is important to note the odds ratio was 0.94. The confidence interval there does hit one. So we'll talk about that in a second. The authors raise, and I think this is fair, the possibility that that does not exclude a potential benefit. Since most of the studies were at high risk of bias, it is, of course, possible that the treatment effect is overestimated. They did a number of subgroup analyses, primary versus secondary prevention, diabetes, proportion of female participants, study duration. Nothing made any difference. Antiplatelet therapy had no effect on cognitive function tests. To my read, though, this is still a pretty interesting study. I take this to mean there's a non-zero chance that this could work. I think it's worthy of more studies. 11 RCTs is not enough for me. I need more than 100,000 people to really make up my mind. Obviously, I'm not going to use this for primary prevention of like all comers, but I would honestly be interested in reading more about its like specific risks and benefits in some selected populations. So people at very high risk of like multi-infarct dementia, I can see like a really clear, you know, cause-effect line here. These people also probably have specific indications for dual antiplatelet therapy anyways, or at least potentially single antiplatelet medications. I mentioned this before, I'm also a little cautious because of the range of outcomes that they included. Various trials, it was about 50-50, so I think they said four of them included outcomes that were a diagnosis of dementia, so clinical diagnosis usually including supplemental cognitive scoring, which to me is a reasonable poem. So somebody clinically diagnosed with dementia, some of them included cognitive scores only. So that for me is a little bit of a less compelling disease-oriented outcome. So again, I think for me, this is not quite a settled thing. I am interested. I'm paying attention to this. I'll be curious to see what we learn more about this in the future. Henry, I know you you read this article too. You wrote this one up. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you hit on a lot of the key issues. That first of all, the study quality frankly sucked. Okay, I think that's a term that we could sometimes use, which really makes me feel like that upper limit of odds ratio of one maybe probably is not really one. The question about the subgroup analyses, the more of those that you do, the greater the likelihood there is of a type 1 error, meaning you find an effect when one really doesn't exist, and that they weren't able to find one suggests to me that there probably is no real effect. The only question, and I don't think they had enough around the issue that you raised, is those patients with multi-infarct dementia. The other caution that you point out is that most of these studies used scores and not clinical assessment by clinicians or patients or their caregivers. And then the last piece, which is my fault, which I usually point out when studies address harms or not, this did not actually address anywhere in the study the harms of antiplatelet therapy. So I think the jury is probably not really out, with the possible exception of those individuals at risk for multi-infarct dementia.
Gary, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, a couple of things. The I squared was zero, which means that all of these studies basically showed the same results, which I think is pretty impressive just in terms of the consistency of the results. I think the other thing in my reading of this is that the average age of the participants was 66 and they had a 5-year follow-up. You know, one wonders whether or not they chose the wrong, or at least the previous studies that were involved in the meta-analysis actually chose the wrong age group. This seems like a relatively young age mm-hmm. upon which to start doing some dementia studies. I mean, if I remember correctly.
Wait a minute. In the past when we've talked about this, you said we started too old. Now you're saying we started too young?
There's got to be a sweet spot. Yeah.
Well, I think one other thing I'd add is that it wasn't always clear to me whether the studies were reporting dementia as a primary outcome or whether it was a secondary outcome or a harm outcome. And those are often measured less reliably. There have been a lot of studies of harm reporting in randomized trials, and that was not always done as thoroughly or as consistently. So I guess that'd be another thing. All righty, good one. So sounds like some of us are DAPT curious and some of us aren't. So Gary's quiz, tell us about it.
All righty. This is about the SGLT, the GLP-1 agonists. Recent study in the New England Journal published last month, and I think it's going to tie in closely to what you're talking about also coming up, Mark. So here's the question. The effect of cardiovascular outcomes of semaglutide in patients with a BMI of greater than 27, which they identify as either overweight or obese, and pre-existing cardiac disease, but no diabetes. Remember, the GLP-1 agonists were originally marketed for diabetes. Now they're obviously trickling down into other groups. So these are heavy people, pre-existing cardiac disease, no diabetes. So what is the effect of semaglutide on this group? A, it increases the risk of cardiovascular events. B, no effect on cardiovascular events. C, reduces the incidence of death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI and non-fatal stroke, or was less effective than placebo in reducing cardiovascular events.
Stay tuned. Henry, tell us about acute ischemic stroke.
Thank you. So this was a poem originally written by our hospitalist colleague, Nita Kulkarni, at Northwestern, and I don't think we've really talked much about her in our previous episodes. So this is a paper that she picked out, published in BMJ just within the last month or so. It's data from the CATIS-2, CATIS-2. I don't know what that stands for, nor do I care, but the focus of this was on patients who present with acute ischemic stroke, comparing early antihypertensive therapy versus delayed. Okay, so they identified adults at least 40 years of age who presented within the first day or two of an acute ischemic stroke and had a systolic blood pressure between 140 and 220. So really significant systolic elevations. Now, kind of like many of the patients that we care for in the hospital, most of these patients, they excluded those that had severe strokes. They excluded those who had hemorrhage. They also excluded those that received either thrombolytic therapy or thrombectomy, and those who had diastolic pressures of 120 or greater. So really a pretty reasonable group of individuals reflective, I think, of most of the ones that we would be seeing and caring for in the hospital. And there was about 5,000 total participants in the study. So the early intervention group, basically, they got started on day one with antihypertensive therapy, and the goal was to reduce the systolic blood pressure by 10 to 20% in that first 24 hours, and then continued over the course of 90 days to reach targets of the systolic blood pressure less than 140 and a diastolic less than 90. The delayed therapy group were basically taken off their antihypertensives until day 8. Okay. And then they started up on blood pressure medications with the same targets as with the intervention group. So at the end of 7 days before the delayed intervention group got treatment, as you might expect, the systolic pressures were about 11%, about 12 millimeters lower in the intervention group. No big deal there. Okay. That's kind of expected. Lets you know that the treatment worked. But at the end of 90 days, the difference was basically a millimeter of mercury. So the regimens worked with regards to blood pressure control. They looked at an outcome, though. The main thing they were interested in was death or dependence, functional dependence using the modified Rankin score. And if you're familiar with that score, it goes from 0 to 5, and 3 to 5 is considered dependent. So it turns out that at the end of that 90 days, there was no statistical difference. It was 12% in the early intervention group, and it was actually lower, 10.5% in the delayed group. Now, when they planned the study, they were expecting to see maybe 25%, and so they didn't hit those targets. But again, you know, this tells me that if anything, the early intervention is actually more harmful than waiting and seeing. And so the bottom line for me is that, and we've seen this many other studies of a similar nature, that early intervention on blood pressure for patients with ischemic stroke, aggressive blood pressure lowering does not improve outcomes. And so there's a paradigm that you could apply to many parameters. But in this case, what my question is, first of all, is the parameter that you're seeing, is the blood pressure normal or not? Okay. If it's not normal, is the blood pressure response, is it a physiologic or compensatory response, or is it pathologic? And if it's pathologic, does intervention actually improve outcomes? And if I think back to the three or four things that I think I remember from medical school, is that when, you know, the brain has that autoregulatory component with regards to blood pressure control, and if you've got an area of the brain because of an ischemic stroke that isn't perfusing, the response is let's raise the blood pressure to reperfuse that area. And so, you know, when we start messing with normal compensatory responses, quite often we see that we invoke more harms than benefits. And I think this study, frankly, reinforces that.
Henry, thanks. That was a great summary. And thank you not for going back into cardiopulmonary physiology for me. I thought I'd forgotten all that for a good reason. But no, seriously, I mean, it does. It's one of those things that makes sense. And as it turns out, probably is true. You know, I guess it's harmful. I think it's maybe, I would qualify that as more likely to be harmful to start early, but you'd have think we'd have figured this out by before 2023, right? This seems like kind of an important question. We were discussing this on rounds when I was an intern, you know, what the best blood pressure control is. And that was like 5-10 years ago, at least.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this has been a topic forever. And, you know, well, okay,
So if these numbers were true, if that was statistically significant, that would translate to a number needed to harm of about 70.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have figured this out. I mean, I want to say a couple of things. So first, excluding people with a severe stroke, hemorrhagic stroke makes sense to me. This was ischemic strokes only. Excluding people with a severe stroke, people who got thrombolytics, which is standard of care, you know, for most folks with an ischemic stroke that you catch in time, thrombectomy, or those with a diastolic pressure of at least 120, that actually excludes a lot of people. So this is a fairly narrow range of folks that are left over. What's currently recommended is that you have permissive hypertension for a day or two, and then you restart the patient on their home blood pressure medications, as long as they are in the hypertensive range, which seems very reasonable to me. You know, that you and we've talked in the past, both I think on the podcast and our live courses, about in general in the hospital, you don't want to be aggressive with blood pressure treatments. That we know that causes harm when people are in the ambulatory setting again, and that's certainly true, I think, in the stroke setting. And so you restart them on their home blood pressure medications as long as it doesn't drop their blood pressures too low, and that seems pretty reasonable here too. I do want to say that CADS, because I know you don't care, but I was then curious, it stands for China Antihypertensive Trial and Acute Ischemic Stroke, Volume 2.
Well, we've been seeing a lot more really high quality, especially cardiovascular trials coming out of China, which is great. You know, it's certainly a major cause of morbidity around the world, but also clearly in China, and stroke in particular. So I think
it does though bring up the question of generalizability, right? And so, you know, does it ethnicity matter when it comes to these types of issues? And I do think that that's something that at least one should think about. I think the other part of this study that I wondered about also was, is 90 days enough time? Now, even if there was a 6-month, 1-year follow up, I suspect personally that it wouldn't be a huge differential, but that's still a pretty short period of time after a stroke to measure some of these outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question of the importance of race and ethnicity and those factors, you know, body mass, et cetera. But I think, you know, I'm always remember when the Japanese trial about aspirin for primary prevention came out back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and it showed no benefit and actually some potential harms of aspirin for primary prevention, the reaction was, but it's not, you know, European population, et cetera. Of course, then three large European studies found exactly the same thing. And I think more often than not, it's just not a factor or at all an important factor. So, I think that we can really learn something from this. Good stuff. Okay, so I think anyone can tell from my voice, I've been lying flat on my back with my legs raised and my GERD is raising havoc with my vocal cords. Anyway, I'll try to squawk through this. So this was a guideline from there are 6 organizations that contributed acronyms to this guideline, including most prominently the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. And this is for management of patients with chronic cardiac disease with circulation 2023. And the first author is Varani. And you thank me in advance. This is a 111-page guideline. And no, I did not read every word. It was based on literature searches focused on published randomized trials or systematic reviews, and they also commissioned their own systematic reviews where needed. There were 26 authors. They included 17 women. And normally I don't go into such detail on the author, the composition of the author panel, but out of 26 authors, 17 were women. Only 6 reported consulting for relevant companies. Only one was on a speaker's bureau. So that is much better in terms of at least gender diversity and lack of conflict of interest than we've seen in a lot of other guidelines. So, you know, way to go, ACC, AHA. And I thank them also because they helpfully summarized the 10 top take-home messages for people like me who are trying to summarize this monstrosity. So they emphasize, okay, here's the, you know, eat your vegetables. They emphasize team-based care that considers social determinants, takes a shared decision-making approach, emphasizes exercise and a healthy diet. Argue against that, you guys. Okay. Then what's new is SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists should now be considered for patients with CHD, including patients without diabetes. Another, not really a change, but an emphasis is beta blockers are no longer routinely recommended long-term, and they really should be limited to folks with some other kind of an indication. So let's see here. Heart failure, MI in the past year, other indications. So they are recommended along with calcium channel blockers as first-line agents for chronic angina symptoms. Now, DAPT, like beta blockers, is no longer a life sentence. DAPT is recommended for 1 to 3 months after a percutaneous intervention in patients with high bleeding risk, 6 months if low to moderate bleeding risk, and 12 months if they've had a prior acute coronary syndrome, but not longer than that routinely. It isn't recommended for patients without recent PCI or those who are more than 12 months out from acute coronary syndrome. Of course, it gets complicated when you start thinking about our previous poem and, you know, those patients who've had maybe multi-infarct dementia or stroke, you know, so it gets complicated. Statins remain the first-line lipid-lowering agent with fish oil, omega-3 fatty acid supplements, and vitamins are not recommended to reduce cardiovascular events based on a lack of benefit in randomized trials. Icosapent ethyl, which is an omega-3 derivative in a pill, is recommended on a limited basis for patients with known heart disease and persistently elevated triglycerides, not just anyone with high triglycerides. And if there are any cardiologists listening in, please take note, routine surveillance stress tests, routine coronary CT, or angiography are not recommended unless there's some change in symptoms or function. And then finally, this is interesting too, from a prevention perspective, e-cigarettes get a qualified recommendation as second or third line agents for smoking cessation, not first line behavioral interventions combined with bupropion, varenicline, and nicotine replacement remain first line for smoking cessation. So bottom line, key changes include shortening the duration of DAPT and beta blockers, not recommending fish oil or omega-3 fatty acids for secondary prevention or primary prevention, not using e-cigarettes as a first line for smoking, but considering it as a second or third line agent, and incorporating SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists for appropriate patients with CHD. Gary, I know this is an area of interest for you.
Mark, I'm giving you an A+. Great job. 111 pages in about 90 seconds. That's excellent. You know, astute listeners will recognize that we covered statins versus other lipid-lowering agents for primary and secondary prevention last month. And oh, by the way, it came up with the same results with regards to same conclusions with regards to statins. A lot of these other second-line agents, there's just not a huge evidence base for that. So it's nice to see that the ACC/AHA has maintained statins as first-line therapies. And I don't want to say they marginalized, but they've actually set aside some of the other more expensive and perhaps harder-to-use agents. The one thing that I have a slight problem with is that they always use the term in select groups, and they never define what they mean by select groups. I'm thinking that the newer kids on the block, the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 agonists, are recommended for select groups of patients with chronic coronary disease, et cetera, including those without diabetes. But I'm not sure why they need the word select in that situation. It almost makes it seem like there's some nuance to this that they don't already define. But anyways, I thought this was a really nice summary, Mark. Good job on that. And some of the stuff's new. Some of the stuff is just reinforcing what we already know.
Science evolves. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, a few things. First, I think this is the first time ever that we've had the quiz actually answered in the podcast. Sorry, Gary, still under thunder, but there it goes.
I spent all week planning this.
Speaking of astute listeners, I think we talked a few weeks ago about e-cigarettes and my personal cautions about them, and the biggest one being they are so much healthier for you than smoking tobacco, but there's some big health-related concerns about them. My biggest concerns about these guidelines and guidelines like them is that Mark was maybe the one person on earth besides the other three of us who were going to read the 111 page. And he just said he didn't do it. He's got nothing else to do nowadays. Can't even leave the house. and the reason I'm worried about that is that not all of these recommendations are going to be made even. Like they don't all have an equal basis of evidence behind them. And so, you know, some of them are, I think you said one of them was a qualified recommendation there. So some of them are going to be a little bit stronger than others, but by the time they get down to us in primary care, we're going to be like, well, this is what the cardiologists say to do. So this is kind of how, you know, our practices are going to kind of morph around these recommendations. And that may not be quite the right thing to do, because some of them are going to be, you know, like really strong recommendations based on a lot of evidence. And some of them are going to be like, this is probably better than what we're currently doing. But so maybe, you know, think about this. And others are going to be, you know, just like a group of cardiologists think this is a good idea. And that may not come through unless, you know, somebody goes to the trouble of reading the whole thing. I nominate Henry.
Hey, Gary, thanks for your insights. And Gary, you're going to give us some insights into probiotics for irritable bowel.
Yes, probiotics. So I needed to make myself smarter on this topic anyway. So this is why I chose this. So probiotics are live microorganisms. They're purported to be useful in certain conditions. They're found in fermented foods like yogurt and sauerkraut. I'm sure that's a common part of your diet, Mark, being from Germany, or also be taken in supplements. Now, there are some specific examples. Lactobacillus and bifidobacterium are both bacteria, commonly found in the gut, part of the natural microbiota, may be used for irritable bowel and diarrhea-related conditions. Saccharomyces is a yeast used to treat diarrhea caused by infections and antibiotics. There's Lactobacillus rhamnosus is a specific strain of Lactobacillus, which we just talked about, and may be helpful in diseases such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Also, to my new knowledge, just in the past couple of days, there are non-pathogenic strains of E. coli that have been used as a probiotic, which competes with pathogenic bacteria in the gut. So that's just a little bit of a background with regards to some of the probiotics that are kind of in the research sphere. So given all this, you might ask yourself, what's the efficacy of probiotics in irritable bowel, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome? And if that's the case, I have the meta-analysis for you, which was published in Gastroenterology in 2023 and entitled The Efficacy of Probiotics in Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. Turns out that about 10% of people with IBS report that their symptoms started after an acute enteric infectious process. It's called post-infectious IBS, and therefore it led to the hypothesis that maybe alterations in the gut microbiome might be involved in this pathophysiology. So these authors looked at just a huge number of studies, 82 trials, over 10,000 patients that specifically compared probiotics to placebo. All trials had to last at least 7 days, long duration, and the outcome was the relative risk of persisting symptoms after treatment. They then reported out the results as a moderate, low, and very low certainty for a beneficial effect. So their outcomes were global symptoms, abdominal pain, and abdominal bloating and distension. What did they find? So they found that there was, there were no high certainty outcomes, or at least beneficial effects found by the authors. There was moderate certainty for evidence of E. coli, the non-pathogenic strain of E. coli, for global symptoms. The other two were low certainty for the benefit of the yeast, the Saccharomyces, as well as the Bifidobacterium for abdominal pain, if you're looking at that symptoms. There was almost no effect for any of the measured or tested probiotics for abdominal bloating and distension. The good news is, again, large study, over 10,000 patients, 82 trials, no significant adverse effects were noted. Now, it turns out that E. coli is not as widely available as Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium. I just did a quick search for this non-pathogenic E. coli, and apparently you can find it online in certain health food stores, et cetera, such as on Amazon. So if global symptoms of IBS is the specific target, and again, global symptoms are just, did they feel better on it or not, quite frankly, non-pathogenic E. coli seems to be best suited for these symptoms. I was doing a quick Google search on this as well. There's some very, very soft evidence that these might have mutagenic potential. So I did a little bit more research and it says this is not well established. So long story short, it seems like the at least low to moderate certainty benefit for certain of these probiotics in the treatment of certain symptoms for IBS.
Very good. Kate, comments?
Well, I'll start with my most favorite fact about probiotics, which is that when they do really good placebo-controlled trials, they have the most ingenious method of making the placebo, which is that they take the usual product and they just heat treat it, and that kills the active bacteria. And I just think that's genius. I just think that's the best way to make a. There is. The other interesting thing that I have, the fun fact that I have to share about probiotics is that I have a little bit of skepticism about some of these, about the quality of the research, because you can trademark individual bacteria. So I can't remember what the probiotic yogurt that used to be on TV so much was called. I can't remember the trade name of it, but they actually trademarked the bacteria that they used to make that yogurt. And so when they would be like, it's the only one that contains this strain, that was because they had trademarked the actual bacterium. And so sometimes when it's much like, you know, Pfizer promoting whatever strain, whatever drug, they can do the same thing with strains of bacteria. So when they're like, well, this kind of bacteria or yeast is the best for this condition, that is not always the most high quality research. And it sort of exists in this, like, you know, semi well-controlled, carefully researched zone where people are sort of paying attention to it, but it's, you know, in this zone between complementary and mainstream research. So those are my two fun facts about probiotics.
And those were fun facts. Henry, what do you
think? Wow, I am learning so
I
much.
I can't wait to share those.
Activia. It was Activia yogurt. Yeah,
that's right. That's
true. So probiotics was one of John Hickner's favorite topics as well. And he often presented this at our conferences. And so this gives us another chance to remember our departed friend. And I will, among all of the fun facts, I will just not share, we'll say for another time, the potential role of sauerkraut in the battle at Gettysburg. My concern about a lot of these issues, besides what Kate raised with regards to the proprietary nature, is that with drug trials, you know, we have registries, clinical trials registries, and there are some probiotics that register for these, but I am still concerned about the role for publication bias and that the deck is stacked in favor of positive trials. And in spite of that, they can't really find a really outstanding set of recommendations here. To me, this notion of, well, let's try this and give it a week or two and see if it makes a difference, that trial and error seems costly and inefficient. So maybe what we need is a poly pill filled with all of the potential probiotics that are out there. And we've talked about poly pills in the past, and so this could potentially have a role for that in the future. The last point that I want to make is that there's an upcoming poem that we'll probably bring up in a few months, within the next couple of months, from the Atlantis trial that enrolled mostly patients with irritable bowel syndrome, with diarrhea, or with mixed, that amitriptyline, which is a cheap medication that's been around for a long time, that this was actually effective. And so I think we probably have some other alternatives for us. Oh, by the way, the American College of Gastroenterology recommends against probiotics as a blanket recommendation. And the British Society of Gastroenterology made a weak recommendation for kind of like chicken soup. It couldn't hurt.
Yeah, I think that's important to note. I mean, the harms, I think, were pretty minimal, if I recall correctly. Yeah, so that's, I mean, I think that's something. And this is a frustrating, life altering potentially condition that's can be very frustrating for patients to tolerate and treat. So I think, you know, a lot of them feel like, hey, I'll try just about anything at this point.
Yeah. And I think the lack of apparent downside anyways, is probably key to me when I'm looking at this. You know, when I think about the use of amitriptyline, the potential for adverse effects cannot be zero.
Yeah. So good point. Okay, you got a quiz for us.
I do, and I have the quiz answer also. I know you all have been waiting on the edge of your seat. So so this is actually just published last month, and the correct answer was C, if you remember, which I don't off the top of my head, the actual foils. Semaglutide, or am I saying it's semaglutide? I don't know where to put the emphasis on which syllable, but reduced the incidence of death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal stroke. This was published December 14th in the New England Journal. It assessed the effect of semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams, slightly higher than what we would use for diabetes, because that's, as I just looked it up, it's 2 milligrams. So they have a slightly higher dose. on cardiovascular risk in patients with a BMI greater than 27, but no diabetes. 17,000 patients followed for 3 years. They found that the primary outcomes, the cardiovascular death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI, and non-fatal stroke, decreased on average 1.5% over 3 years. So the NNT was approximately 67. Additionally, the group that was in the active treatment group lost 10% of body weight versus 1% versus placebo. So this just reinforces, I think, what Mark was talking about with regards to the updated guidelines, the potential use of these in patients without diabetes as a preventer of MACEs, major adverse cardiovascular events.
Good stuff. Okay, well, thank you, Gary. Thank you for enlightening us, everybody. And thanks for the listeners for tuning in. You don't really tune into a podcast, do you? I'm picturing the dial. if you want CME credit, ifu.com, online education webpage. It's the Oxy talking. It's the Oxy. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to give us credit. You can get up to a half an AMA Category 1 credit. There's a conflict of interest policy you can read if you're super bored, and disclosures as well. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.